Feel like you're stuck in career limbo? Clock in, clock out, repeat. No growth, no new opportunities. It's time to break out and break into tech. With CBT Nuggets, you can start building the IT skills that companies are hiring for right now. We make training fast, simple, and practical. From networking to cybersecurity, you'll get short, easy-to-watch videos and hands-on virtual labs so you can build real-world skills without expensive gear or complicated setups. For just $59 a month, you get unlimited access to our full training library. That includes certifications, skill-based learning, and practice exams, a $100 value included free. Learn anytime, anywhere, and get job ready on your terms. Thousands have used CBT Nuggets to launch new careers, and you can too. Right now, CBT Nuggets is offering a free trial. Easily find the training you need and test it out with no commitment. Start your 7-day free trial now at cbtnuggets.com. Don't wait. A better job is just a few clicks away.
Welcome to the Nation Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of our biggest stories with the journalists who wrote them. I'm Didi Guttenplan, editor of The Nation. For sports fans in the U.S., betting has never been more common or more accessible. But under the surface of this booming pastime, a darker story is unfolding. As gambling and sports wagering have become more legal and less taboo, gambling addiction rates have soared, and government response has been minimal. Amid rising global instability and unprecedented user access, bookies now profit not just from football and basketball games, but from predicting elections and any other range of geopolitical events you could imagine. How did we get here? Economists have a name for it, casino capitalism, a world where the financial system mirrors a Las Vegas den of sin. Joining us to unpack this new reality is writer and researcher John Semley, whose work has appeared in The New Republic, The Baffler, The Guardian, and many other outlets. His latest article, Casino Capitalism 2.0, appears in the June issue of The Nation. John, thank you for joining us, and welcome to the Nation Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So let's start where your story starts, with a gambling addict. Tell us a little bit about this guy and how you came to meet him and his story.
So I came across in my research a young man named Rob Minnick, who does social media content related to gambling. Now, unlike most people his age who do social media content related to gambling, he's actually warning against it. It's much more common on YouTube and TikTok to see people talking about the bets that they're laying, filming themselves playing blackjack. There's a style of content that people call loss porn, where you sort of brag about how much money you've hemorrhaged in a session. Rob is a recovering gambling addict who talks frankly about the perils of the gambling industry to people his age. I reached out to him to see if he'd be interested in chatting for the article. And I was surprised, well, maybe not surprised, but he lived right in my neighborhood here in Philadelphia, which I suppose is not surprising because Pennsylvania was an early adopter of the new regulated gambling landscape. And also, as anyone knows, a huge sports town. So he is a person who I think typifies the kind of younger, he's 25, so I think a Zoomer he would be. That demographic of new gamblers who sort of came up from watching sports as young people, having their sort of social life and family lives based around sports. You know, he told me if we ever had a family event during football season, it would be on a Sunday so everyone could watch the Eagles game. To someone who got into what they call fantasy sports and from there into kind of hardcore sports betting and casino gambling, which was his ruin. To the extent that someone in their early 20s can be ruined. Luckily, at that point, you don't have a lot of money and you can kind of bounce back from it.
Well, it depends on who you borrow from, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, and there's stories where he had to sort of borrow money from his parents to pay back bookies initially. And he said something very telling to me, which is that for years, he thought that he didn't have a gambling problem. He thought that his issue was financial, essentially that he wasn't making enough money, that he wasn't working hard enough at his jobs to essentially support what he understood as a hobby. Eventually, like a lot of people, when they confront addiction, they reach what, you know, addiction specialists sometimes call a rock bottom. And he realized that, no, I have a gambling issue.
Well, and his rock bottom was fairly vivid. Do you want to?
Yes. So he was speaking to a woman in Paris who he was kind of messaging with and talking with online, and he had a big win gambling. So he's like, well, I think I'll fly to Paris and sort of strike up a relationship with this woman. Shortly after he arrived, he found himself in the bathroom of his hotel in Paris, sitting on the toilet playing online blackjack and baccarat and essentially losing all the money that he had brought to go on this trip and woo this woman. And he had to call a friend and ask him to send him money so he could kind of eke his way through this, what should have been a romantic holiday. And, you know, it was at that point, I think, you know, you're in a Parisian hotel with your pants around your ankles on the toilet playing online baccarat on a foreign website, where he kind of had the light bulb that
maybe this is a problem.
It's not a hobby anymore. Yeah, it's a problem. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know, you know, with gambling now or with addiction, people almost talk about how it's sort of good to reach that phase. You have to reach a certain point where you can have that epiphany that it's out of your control. I don't know if they're quite that colorful. To be honest, some are probably much worse than that. Some people probably don't make it to Paris.
Let's talk a little bit about how we got here. There's always been gambling on sports in the United States. You know, anybody who ever watched Guys and Dolls will remember the oldest established permanent floating crap game in New York. Of course, it used to be illegal. But even in my childhood, I remember, and this is probably true for a lot of people who become gambling addicts, gambling was a way to sort of participate in a sport that you didn't otherwise really have any entree to. I remember as a teenager and in my 20s betting on every fight that Muhammad Ali fought. Mm-hmm. And to me, it seemed like a way of almost supporting Ali. You know, the pundits would say he had no chance. I'd put $5 on him. He usually won, but the usually winning was nice. I never won very much money. It was more like, you know, you think Ali doesn't have a chance, I'll show you he has a chance. So right. It was a way of participating for someone who was not otherwise in any way athletically inclined.
I always think of the line from The Simpsons that I don't think made it into the piece, but Homer explains his daughter that gambling is just something daddies do to make sports more fun. and I think that that's true to an extent. I mean, you know, I think, you know, betting on the Super Bowl, even betting on the weekly football slate is something that people have done for generations, but in a more fairly traditional way where you might know a bartender at, you know, your local hole in the wall who takes bets on the games at Sunday, and you can bet on the favorite or maybe the over under on the score or the spread. Now we have kind of these complex online systems where you can bet on practically anything. The number of catches a player will have, I'm using football as an example, the number of yards by a player, interceptions, sacks, any stat is basically something that you can now lay a wager on.
So there's a couple of pieces here that I want to disentangle. And one is the spread of legalized gambling. So, you know, you no longer have to go down to your local hole in the wall or get a telephone number of a bookie because, you know, in, I think you said every state but four, there's some form of legalized gaming.
Yes. So essentially what happened is until 1992, let's talk about sports betting, I guess, because sure. It's kind of the stalking horse. There was a law called the Professional Amateur Sports Protection Act that federally outlawed betting on sports. And it's sort of incredible to believe now, but all of the major leagues and the collegiate leagues loved this. They were so worried that legalized betting on sports would essentially compromise the integrity of the sport. Now, what happened is in 2018, starting around 2012, there were a series of legal challenges led by the governor of New Jersey, originally under Chris Christie, ruling that the Sports Protection Act was unconstitutional because the 10th Amendment says that states can make determinations on anything that's protected by the federal government, and that included gambling regulation, right? It's the same amendment that people use to advocate for cannabis legalization.
It's the reserve powers clause.
Exactly. So after years of challenges sort of spearheaded by the New Jersey government, finally in 2018, the Supreme Court relented and said, you know, fine, you can bet on sports and you can take bets at casinos and legal sports books. Of course, as tends to happen when this happened in New Jersey, well, then it sort of spread out across the states. What also happened is a number of digital apps. Is that what you say? A digital app? Phone applications. A number of apps that people use for fantasy sports, which I don't know if we want to get into that. But, you know, places like DraftKings and FanDuel, the one you see all the commercials for, they started offering legal sports betting within the apps. Now, after that, Then you can play live blackjack in the apps. Then you can play slot machines in the apps. And then all of a sudden, you have, as the commercials might put it, the thrill of Las Vegas in your palm.
Right, in your pocket or in the toilet when you're sitting with your pants down.
While you're waiting for a Parisian woman to go.
You know, and before we move too quickly through this, and I mean, your telling in the story is wonderfully pacey, so I'm going to slow it down a little bit and try and go a little bit deeper. That's one of the things we do on the Nation podcast.
Yes.
You know, the reasons for restricting betting on sports were not crazy. I mean, you know, people remember the Black Stock scandal of 1919, which, mm-hmm. you know, seemed to say that a professional Major League Baseball team had thrown the World Series. There was the New York University had lost its basketball team because they were implicated in throwing games in the 30s and 40s, or maybe it was the 40s and 50s. You know, the idea that if you have millions of dollars at stake on sporting contests where the participants are poorly paid athletes or even unpaid amateurs, that they might be tempted to, you know, shave a point, that didn't seem crazy. So, Now that everything's legal, are all our sports totally above board and nobody ever suspects anything gambling of having any influence?
Well, that's a complicated question. And, you know, and as I mentioned, when this Supreme Court challenge was happening, and again, this is only a couple of years ago, but it strikes me as unfathomable to even think of now, the four major sports leagues and the NCAA, which regulates college sports, they sued New Jersey saying that, no, you cannot bring this legislation forward because it will totally foster suspicion. Now, of course, they all have partnerships with these gambling apps and that. But the short answer is that, yes, I think it does foster suspicion. I talked to a sports writer in the piece named Arif Hassan. He did a lengthy kind of blog post analyzing this. And, you know, I think there's kind of like a lazy cultural thing. I mean, I know guys who I talk about sports with who will claim that everything is rigged and, you know, oh, the Kansas City Chiefs, they don't get any calls, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But now there's definitely a thing where everything is kind of under suspicion. There was a play in last year's football season where a New York Giants running back sort of slid short of the goal line. Right. So before being able to get the 6 points for a touchdown, that was immediately online cast as being suspect. Well, why would he slide? Why would he not get the point? He's trying to keep the score under a certain amount to help people who have bet this, and maybe he's bet it himself. Now, there are perfectly good reasons for a player to do that, specifically that if you don't get the point, you don't turn the ball over and let the other team score. But in the eyes of people betting on sports, it was immediately seen as suspect. Players not getting targeted by a quarterback, or players just kind of, for lack of a better word, half-assing it on the court, are seen as kind of being in the bag somehow. And, you know, there have been cases when players have been caught gambling and have been disciplined for it. So there's reason for suspicion. But I do think that suspicion runs higher. And in the piece, I talk about how, you know, gambling, this thing that was meant to kind of juice the excitement of sports, it risks ruining that excitement.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you point to two big, I would say, hinge moments or changes in our culture around sports and gambling. And, you know, one which we've talked about a bit is the massive explosion in legalized gambling and the ease with which Americans can now bet on all sorts of sports. And I say Americans because, you know, this has been true in other cultures for a long time. In any working class neighborhood in the United Kingdom, if you walk two blocks, you'll see what they call a turf accountant, which is a bookie on the corner. And they were, you know, they're called turf accountants because they originally took bets on horses, but you can bet on Premier League soccer. You can bet on anything. And as I discovered when I lived in England, they take proposition bets too. Mm-hmm. So you can bet on who's going to win the presidential election in the U.S. or they'll give you odds on even who the Democratic nominee is going to be if it's a big enough bookmakers chain. But so one thing is that the U.S. has become in that way more like other countries, and that there's been our Puritan heritage has been overcome and we have much more widespread access to legal gambling. But the other thing that you talk about, and I think this is in a way maybe the more intellectually interesting part of the piece, is what you call gamblification. Mm-hmm. So before we get to gamblification, which I want to in a second, I just want to, for those of our listeners who are not gamblers, you've used some terms like over under and the spread. Yes, so yes. Do you want to say what those are?
This is a piece, I must say, where you have to do a lot of showing your work, because as someone who watches sports and I will say bets on them, you take the stuff for granted. So you not only have to explain a lot of sports terms, you have to explain a lot of betting terms. So, the over under is fairly easy to understand. Let's take a football game. If the over under is at 37.5, that means that both teams will combine for that score. So to bet the over would be a bet on anything over 38. To bet the under would be anything on 37. That's been a fairly common bet for ages. The other one that's always a bit trickier to understand is spread betting, which is the spread is the difference between the scores of each team. So let's take my two favorite teams, the Philadelphia Eagles and the Buffalo Bills. The spread is Philadelphia -7. That means the Eagles are expected to beat the Buffalo Bills by 7 points.
So if the Eagles beat the Bills by 5 points, you lose.
You do not cover the spread. No.
Right.
If you bet them to cover, then they'd have to win by 7 or more. Spread betting was invented by a very clever college basketball handicapper in, I believe, the 80s. And it's a great form of betting because it essentially makes the games more fun. You don't always, because of the mismatches of teams, it's not reasonable that certain teams will beat other teams, but if they can cover the spread, it gives the excitement to the gambler that's as good as winning, if not better. So, yes, I never thought I'd have to explain spread betting on a podcast before. But
are there other terms that we need to know before we proceed?
Well, you mentioned prop bets, and prop bets are, I think, increasingly popular. That's when you kind of bet on things a player might do. So you might bet in a basketball game, Jalen Brunson will have 27 points and 6 rebounds or something like that. And the other big one that comes up in the article and nowadays, which is sort of the driver of the sports betting public health problem, if you want to consider it that, is parlay betting. And a parlay bet is when you string together a number of bets, say 3, 4, 5 winners in a week of a football slate, and they all have to come true for you to win that bet. But if they do, the odds of the bet multiplies. So it's become almost a form of social interaction for people, especially younger people, to share their kind of parlay bet slips and to tail their friends' bets and kind of get in on it and try to get rich together. Do they get rich? Of course it happens. People do win, but not the majority of people.
Well, yeah, somebody has to win the lottery, but most of the people who buy tickets don't.
So. Are subsidizing that win, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. That was very useful. I have to say, and this will both date me and place me as a non-sports bettor, when I think of a proposition bettor, I think of Sky Masterson and Nathan Detroit and whether they sell more cheesecake or more strudel. But but I guess you can generalize that into sports if you want to. Anyway, so gamblification. Now, I think to get to gamblification, we have to start with casino capitalism, which essentially was the idea that people who were putting their money in the stock market were mostly gambling rather than taking a view on the future profits of large multinational corporations, that it was the stock market and its activity, a large portion of its activity in any case, came more and more to resemble a casino, and that people were putting money in to gamble rather than because they thought that Kleenex was going to sell more tissues than Kimberly Clark or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it was coined by an economist named Susan Strange, which is a great name. And as you suggested, it has more to do with massive speculation and sort of betting more on a volatile boom bust structure of the stock market than on, reliable blue chip returns and all those things we like to ideally put our money into.
Okay, so we have casino capitalism, but this piece is casino capitalism 2.0 because that's not really what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I came upon this idea of gamblification, and it was really what led me to wanting to write the piece. I mean, I certainly won't be accused of being the first person to point out that there are public health issues associated with the recent boom in sports betting and gambling. But what really led me to wanting to write about this as someone who watches sports and engages with a lot of sports media was seeing how much the language of gambling had entered sports, and especially sports casting. I remember watching a football game last season that was low scoring, and the venerable broadcaster Al Michaels said something like, well, that'll be good news for the underbettors, meaning that a low score would be good news for people who bet the under on that game. More than that, if you watch broadcasts, you will see live betting odds come up on screen. If you listen to sports podcasts, I think I mentioned The Ringer and Bill Simmons, I mean, they're kind of the kings of this area, but they'll do whole episodes where people are just predicting bets on the games, of course, working hand in hand with FanDuel, one of the largest online gambling operators. So it's not only that people are gambling and that, you know, there are harms associated with that gambling. I should also say for the record, like, I do gamble. I'm not a moralist in any way. I'm not some sort of Puritan teetotaler saying we shouldn't gamble. But what I mean by gamblification is that gambling is informing not only how we think about sports, but how we think about everything. It kind of came to me when I was watching a commercial, I think it was a FanDuel commercial, that said, everything in life's a bet. Thanksgiving dinner, 10-to-1 odds that your uncle's in a food coma or a regular coma. And this idea that you could essentially put odds on everything, that everything was kind of left to like fickle chance. And not only that, but you could speculate and potentially profit on everything is essentially what I mean by gamblification. That gambling becomes kind of the lens through which we start to
through which
to
you
view.
See everything.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I thought that was very interesting. And I thought it was interesting, you know, you talk about the way in which the widespread, the explosion of sports betting has changed the way people view sports. Mm-hmm. You talk about the way in which gambling has influenced sports and the way we view sports and the way in which it has rightly led to an increased amount of suspicion about certain behaviors on the field or on the court. But in gamblification, what you see is the extension of that suspicion to everything in life. You know, mm-hmm. in other words, like maybe a football game is rigged, but maybe our elections are rigged. You know, maybe law enforcement is rigged. Maybe the Constitution is rigged. Maybe everything is rigged. And where does that, you know, that cynicism may not matter so much if you're trying to decide whether you're going to bet on a, you know, March Madness game, but.
It almost does matter. It informs your decision to bet on it. You know, if you believe that these things are being set or arranged in some way, it almost encourages you to want to lay a bet on it, right?
You mean if you can predict which way it's rigged?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, who knows? We can't get inside the conclave, but maybe the refs aren't throwing enough flags right now or something like that. But yeah, I mean, another big part of this piece is, you know, precisely how the naturalization of sports betting and gambling terminology has moved into other arenas. Like I say, a difficult part of this piece was trying to make accessible just the kind of language around sports and betting itself. But I think, you know, there are these other markets, prediction markets, as they've called, that have opened up where one can bet on political election outcomes, papal conclave outcomes, totally frivolous things like how many times will Elon Musk tweet in a day, or, you know, weirdly cynical things like how many Palestinian refugees will there be by the end of June? So these are all kind of cryptocurrency-backed prediction markets, as they call it. But yeah, I think it's very odd these days that, as that FanDuel commercial says, everything in life is a bet. And if you want to, you can find action on basically everything. I mentioned the sort of gambling social media ecosystem. This is something of a joke. Like, you'll see videos of two guys sitting outside a window and throwing out birdseed and being like, over under on how many pigeons come here right now. You know, anything. Over under on how many people will cross on this green light, right?
That, in a way, takes us back to Guys and Dolls. But you talk about this British bookmaker, Paul Krishnamurthy. So tell our listeners a little bit about him.
So Paul is the political bookmaker for, I believe, Bet Online, which is an offshore casino. I should say offshore casinos, places based in Panama and whatnot. You can bet on a lot more stuff on them. The DraftKings and the FanDuels and the BetMGMs and the one you tend to see the commercials for lack of a better word, they're a bit more straight. You can't just kind of get, you know, action on anything. But he basically had always been sort of interested in politics and always interested in betting. And then in 2016, he was hired by Politico to travel the U.S. and cover the presidential primaries. So he did a series of columns where, you know, instead of the usual kind of like recapping of what happens on the election trail, he was sort of bringing a gambler's eye to these races. He'd offer odds on the primaries. I think he said 59-1 that Michael Bloomberg would win the Democratic candidacy. And he would sort of describe these outcomes as a gambler would,
right?
Because he was a gambler. And now he sort of brought that expertise to literally being the one who sets, as they call, the lines for an offshore gambling website where you can go and place your money on these outcomes.
Well, this, I mean, that part of the piece really grabbed me for a couple of reasons, one of which is purely personal, which is that in 2008, a friend and I put together a proposal to have an online election betting website.
Okay.
And we had interest from a bookmaking company in Britain, and we essentially had to abandon it because it was still illegal. And right. As Americans, we would have been arrested the minute we tried to get back into the country.
Panamanian citizenship, I think you know.
What led me to that in 2008 was exactly the sense which, I mean, I had been covering elections since 1988. And as part of my own, I guess, best practice as a reporter, I would always look at the odds on places that ordered odds. And I would always look at, you know, what they call the futures market or the prediction market or the betting market on candidates, because it struck me then as a more useful data point than a lot of polling, because people had skin in the game. You know, you can tell a pollster anything, but if you actually put money down, then you really mean it.
Yes, I make that exact point. I mean, we can say we want something to happen, but, you know, laying your money on something has there's an honesty to it that might sound awfully cynical. But if you're willing to wager cold hard cash that your certain candidate won an election, it says something more than just you saying yeah to a pollster when they're bothering you during dinner or something like that.
But it struck me that Bet Online is Panama based. Mm-hmm. But then you talk about something called Polymarket, which takes similar kinds of bets, but they're based in New York. So how does that work?
I should say that I think they're based technically offshore, but they have an office in Manhattan. They're backed with cryptocurrency, so obviously that's a whole different realm of deregulation. But Polymarket, I mean, they're the ones, I will say Krishnamurti, to his credit, BetOnline offers some really fun bets. Like, I think one of them I came across was which biblical miracle will be the next to be confirmed by science.
Oh, yes.
And I think the easy money was on turning water into wine. but Krishnamurti, he's like, you know, I have good taste about it, right? He's not betting on, you know, casualties and things like that. Polymarket is where you can bet on things like, you know, the number of Palestinian refugees, if the U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip by July, and my favorite, in heavy inverted commas, if a nuclear weapon will be detonated by June 30th, 2025. So I guess that's one benefit.
I suppose that's some consolation as you shiver in your bunker.
Yeah, and good luck spending the money in the nuclear wasteland. I mean, maybe cryptocurrency will finally be useful then. You do have these places where, I don't know, maybe I'm a bit of a moralist, but it does strike me as a bit more cynical than just like, who's going to be the Republican candidate? One piece of context I do want to say about 2016, which I mentioned because that was when Krishnamurti was covering the primaries, that was a banner year for political betting markets because both the Trump election and Brexit were perceived as massive upsets. Nobody thought they would happen, right? So obviously when there's a massive upset, anyone who bet on it makes a lot of money and they start suddenly seeing this as, you know, not just a novel thing like you would do as an office pool, but a place where you can make some serious change. So it's in 2016 that these kind of alternative betting markets have really boomed.
So in other words, if you'd seen Brexit coming, even if you thought it was a bad idea, if you'd put money on it, you'd have made a lot of money.
You'd have made a lot of money. And I'll say this from personal experience. I was living in Canada at the time. And I was so convinced that Brexit was not going to happen. I'm going to say, I'm going to take all my Canadian dollars that I have to my name. I'm going to buy British pounds. Tomorrow, when this doesn't go through, those pounds are going to go through the roof. And I'll exchange them and I'll have a tidy little windfall. And boy, am I glad that I was too lazy to go and do that. but I've also heard, and you know, this is a little bit more anecdotal, but when it came to the presidential election, I had a friend tell me that, you know, he didn't want Trump to win, but he placed a bet that Trump would win as a form of kind of emotional arbitrage. He's like, well, at least if the outcome that I dislike doesn't come to pass, I can make a little money off of it, which is like, you know, something I've heard people do with sports. You know, I bet against my home team because if my home team wins, I'm happy. But if they lose, then I get a little payday, right? But now it seems to be, at least anecdotally, something that people are doing with politics.
Interesting. And I think one of the things that was very striking about your piece was that the reality of who is getting hooked by this new gamblification of American life is not what we expect. You know, you talk about the picture we all have of, I think your phrase was, a blue-haired woman at a slot machine, you know, feeding quarter after quarter.
Tethered in with those sort of loyalty cards, yeah. I mean, I think the main thing is that it's really trending younger. And I should say, I come to writing about this as someone with basically no background writing about sports, but I did write a piece for The Baffler a year or two ago about the rise of fantasy sports. And I do feel in a very deliberate way that fantasy sports are kind of training wheels for sports gambling. And for people who don't take part in fantasy, although tens of millions do, it's where you kind of draft a lineup of players that you have for a team. And depending on how those players perform week after week, you get points and you compete in a league with your friends or work buddies. And maybe everyone throws in, you know, $50 and there's a $600 pot at the end of the season or something.
So it's
like that.
I mean, I'm just going to explain this for people who don't do it. I don't do it, but I know a lot of people who do it, which is you, if you're doing, for example, soccer, which is a pretty popular fantasy sport, You pick your own lineup from all the players who are actually playing, but they don't all have to be on the same team because you're making your own team. But then their performance in their actual games affects how your fantasy team does.
Exactly.
And some of them are done just for bragging rights, and some of them are done for relatively small pots or cash prizes.
Yeah, and I mean, fantasy is like one of the most popular pastimes in America and probably in other countries as well. But the thing that when I say that fantasy is training wheels for gambling, I mean, not only because you have this kind of like, you know, fairly modest pot where, again, you might walk away with, you know, $300 or $400 at the end of the year. It's a nice little chunk of change, but it's not going to change anyone's life. But the way that it is training you to think about gambling is because you start thinking about player props. You start watching sports and thinking not just about the final score, but about how many yards is this player going to get? How many catches are they going to have? How many touches is a running back going to have at the ball? How many rebounds will this player have in a basketball game? And once you start thinking of sports like that, A, you become very invested in watching games, even if you don't really care about the final score. B, you become very invested in teams that are not your own. And C, you start thinking about how you could potentially profit off all this knowledge. This is a big reason why I think the major leagues have supported fantasy and then gambling so strongly, because let's take this year's Super Bowl, for example. Now, I'm a Philadelphia Eagles fan, so I watched that to the bitter end, and every Patrick Mahomes sack, I was on my feet cheering. But I know many people who turned the game off at halftime because they were so far ahead. Now, if you're betting on that game, even if you're not interested in the action because it's so lopsided, you're still going to watch because you're waiting for the number of catches, the number of yards to come through, for all these stats to accumulate by the end of it. The leagues know this, and they know that it captures viewership, which is part of why they've supported it. It's how they've gone from, you know, suing to make sure that gambling wouldn't be legalized to now having partnerships with sports books. They know it keeps people engaged longer, it gets them watching more games, and therefore they can sell more advertisements.
But isn't there also another Marxist level to this? I mean, this is the Nation podcast, after all.
Always.
Which is that as teams become less equal, and as inequality becomes structural in certain sports and in certain games, you know, because the winning teams have more and more to spend, and there's less control on how they spend their money, and the fact that they have access to more capital means that over time, you know, and obviously there are exceptions to this, and we love the exceptions. Just as we love the triumph of, you know, proletarian revolutions. But in general, the teams with the biggest asset base tend to do better than those with the smaller asset base. And that will make sports more predictable. At least the overall outcome is more predictable. So this is a way that instead of regulating and leveling, as it were, the playing field, it keeps spectators involved without having to do that.
It generates a sort of, perpetual interest, again, in all teams, all players, all outcomes. You know, they're obviously except the NFL, weirdly, because of all the sort of moral and ethical problems that come up around that league, is the great socialist sports league because it has a salary cap and redistribution of all profits against all teams. So that's how you can be the Dallas Cowboys and be the most profitable sports franchise in the world and, you know, not make it to the Super Bowl in 30 years. But yeah, definitely. I think that there's a way in which this is,
as I say in the piece, essentially a wealth transfer from people who bet on sports to not only the people who take bets on sports, but to the leagues themselves. It makes sense that they've gone from stridently disavowing sports betting, corrupting games, to encouraging people to bet on it, while at the same time maintaining that it doesn't corrupt the game. Although they do so with a wink and a nudge. The NFL did a series of ads last season. People always joke that the league is scripted, and they did kind of a writer's room bit where they were writing out the scripts for all the games for the year. So to the mind of the totally sort of deranged gambler, this would be seen as an admission. But I think as it is right now, the leagues are just kind of playing footsie with this idea that the fix is in.
Well, but that does lead to, you know, a fairly obvious question, which is if you think that these trends are not healthy, either for sports or for American society, what can be done?
Yeah, well, I think a big thing, and this is interesting because when I talk to people who work on problem gambling, they always say, well, we're not pro or anti-gambling. They have to take this kind of very neutral stance, which I suppose I can understand from a professional level. But I think really what needs to be done is, you know, people will brag about how much money is being levied through legalized gambling, but I think that those avails have to go back into the communities. I mean, one thing that led me to writing about this piece is I think in general at a personal level, when it comes to drugs, sex work, you know, name your quote vice, I tend to believe in that sort of harm reduction model where you can reduce the most egregious excesses and harms of different substances or behaviors by essentially bringing them into the daylight and offering resources for people who really struggle with them. Gambling, because so little of that money actually goes back into the communities, is like totally the opposite. If you see an ad for a gambling website, they kind of mumble, call 1-800-GAMBLER if you have a gambling problem at the end, you know, with that same hurried cadence right. as a pharmaceutical ad telling you that an antidepressant is going to make you suicidal or something like that. But in many jurisdictions, there's no obligation to donate this money back. There's no obligation to put it into resources. And I think that there should be. There also hasn't been a major study on the harms of gambling done in the U.S. for about 20, 25 years. And I think that's very deliberate.
You know, with, for example, legalized marijuana, most states have some kind of provision in the legalization where you have to reinvest in the community, where you have to have funds for treatment. And the idea is, yes, we can raise money for other things, schools, transit, whatever, but we're recognizing that there is going to be some additional harm caused by this, and so we're trying to mitigate it and fund the mitigation. That isn't the case with gambling.
No, I mean, it is the case to a certain extent, and it depends from state to state. In some states, the idea of, you know, funding resources for gamblers is totally voluntary. There's no obligation to do it whatsoever. So, you know, I guess my sort of strident statist take on it would be that they should be mandatory and they should be conducted at higher levels. You know, the issue with this is, and again, I will say I'm not some moralist who thinks that people shouldn't gamble, but it is extremely hard to put the genie back in the bottle, right? Legalized sports betting is probably here to stay. But what we have to do is try to get to a point where I spoke to people for the article who are convinced that the end result of this will just be the utter decimation of the middle class. Now, that would be a horrible thing. So you have to sort of put guardrails in place to make sure that this doesn't happen. With those guardrails, I'm sure that DraftKings and Caesars Casino and the NFL and MLB will still make plenty of money. So everyone can be happy, and hopefully we won't just kind of, ruin a generation that is already struggling financially. As I say in the piece, I sort of see sports betting and especially the parlay betting as consistent with sort of other speculative, quote, assets like cryptocurrency, which have gained popularity.
Well, because people come to feel that there is no mainstream road to prosperity.
Yeah, I mean, I came across an article in my research that was called Gen Z's American Dream, Five-Leg Parlay Your Way to Basic Physiological Needs. Now, obviously, that's a little tongue-in-cheek, but I think for a lot of people, it is true. Your best hope of having some sort of stable middle-class lifestyle is to win a long-shot bet on the Sunday football slate. And, you know, again, I think that's kind of sad and pathetic. You know, I think that football is fun to bet on, $20 or $50 a week if you can afford it. And, you know, beyond that, I think it becomes a real problem.
Okay. John, is there something I should have asked you that I haven't?
Who do I have in the NHL finals? Oh. Well, no, I'm kidding, of course. No, I think we've covered a lot of ground. I mean, I encourage people to read the article. Like I say, you know, there's certainly a wealth of literature out there that are talking about people going broke from gambling on sports, but really I wanted to look at this landscape, you know, this idea of gamblification and how it's sort of changing how we, and especially how younger people, engage with America and the world around us. And I think I do a competent job.
I think you do a great job. John Semlie, whose article, Casino Capitalism 2.0, is in the June issue of The Nation. Thanks so much for coming on The Nation podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
In state and local government, tech upgrades aren't optional. They're essential. Whether it's improving digital services, protecting public data, or modernizing outdated systems, the demand for skilled IT professionals has never been higher. CBT Nuggets helps you stay ahead with affordable, on-demand IT training that's built for your schedule. Our short, practical videos and hands-on virtual labs make it easy to build real-world skills in networking, cybersecurity, cloud technologies, and more. You don't need expensive hardware or complicated setups, just a browser and the motivation to grow. Whether you're an IT admin, public service tech, or new to the field, CBT Nuggets gives you the tools to better support your team and your community. And with new content added regularly, there's always something relevant to learn. Join thousands of learners who are upgrading their skills and advancing their careers. Start your 7-day free trial today at cbtnuggets.com. Because smarter tech skills don't just help you, they help your whole community succeed.